Nick Capaldi and I wrote a book called The Two Narratives of Political Economy. And within the last few years, that idea has flourished. We are more and more in tranquility of mind that we have, in fact, chosen the right path. And these two narratives, broadly stated, are the narratives of equality and the narrative of liberty, borrowing in some sense from Tocqueville, but also Nick's independent mind. We can understand these two narratives in terms of A, an idea, and B, an event. The idea would be, following what we just heard, some kind of interrelationship between economics and politics, without which we could not have political economy, and some other aspect, where we would call it religion or ethics or morality. I think the liberty narrative suggests private property or the right to earn the fruits of one's labor, the religious liberty or the right to worship God as one pleases, and political liberty, which is the right to choose the form of government under one which one lives. And the three go together in a very, very interesting fashion and raises the issue of one, can one have one without the other? Is it just a correlation or is there a causation going on? The other narrative, which we would associate not with Locke, the first narrative is liberty, the second narrative, Rousseau. And the Rousseau narrative answers the three issues of economics, politics, and religion in a different way. Private property is theft. And that goes all the way through, despite corrections by Marx or Proudhon, and into the 20th century. Property is basically theft. So any regime that is based on the protection of private property is inherently nasty. The religious question is that there is no such thing as a private conscience or an appeal to some natural right outside. That is, the only appeal is to the general will, which leads straight into politics, which is the politics of the general will. There is no separation of powers. There's the sort of centralized administration. So these two narratives involve liberty and equality, but in three interrelated ways, which I think builds on what we heard about Adam Smith. But Rousseau has the same one from the opposite side as does Marx. The event, those are the ideas. The event, I would argue, is first of all the American Revolution, which culminates, in my opinion, in the American Constitution. And it's the French Revolution, which is the equality narrative, Rousseau narrative, which culminates in the French constitutions. And if you take a look at both, some very interesting issues with regard to the ideas. The ideas fulfill themselves in these two, in the French Revolution and Constitution and the American Revolution and Constitution. And I think that the U.S. story is one of sort of liberty and resisting the onslaught of equality with some touches of virtue or whatever. And the Rousseau narrative has essentially dominated not only the intellectual world, but the European world. That's sort of the framework in which I want to put the American tradition. The second point I want to make is that if we take a look at equality narrative in the United States, and using the word equality broadly understood, and I'm not suggesting that the word remains the same through the centuries. There are corrections. For example, Marx corrected Rousseau. Rousseau did not have a dialectic. Marx corrects the Rousseau narrative. I don't mean that it improves it. It corrects it while keeping to the notion that property is theft and religion is an opiate and politics of a parliamentary nature is just talk. That the key, it seems to me, to the equality narrative is force or control. And therefore, if we take a look at, say, two or three thinkers very quickly in one sentence, to try to capture how that concept plays its way out in the American tradition, perhaps the original is the clearest, Charles Beard, that the American Constitution, the American Revolution, is an act of force. People knew what they were doing. They were forcing a certain property-owned document on the unsuspecting, yet-to-be-discovered proletariat. And as a consequence, America is ill-founded. And it's all done by force or control. If we go through the progressives, we see the same story. The robber barons, there's some kind of forceful act that is taking place that is only liberty for the few. The downtrodden are not helped, as Adam Smith perhaps had hoped and used as the measure. It ain't happening. And if we go all the way through to Howard Zinn, it's the same story, that America is ill-founded, it's based on control and force. Just look at the victims. Capitalism is slavery. And if we go to Piketty, Piketty is saying the same thing. What is his model? The French Revolution. Who is his hero? Rousseau. What is the whole case against inequality of income? Property basically is theft and owned only by the few. So America is rather nasty and rather ill-founded, and political economy is simply the act of the few to control the many. Now, if we go to another model, which is sort of partly equality, partly liberty, with a dab, which I would call a dab of virtue. And I say it in this way because there's a sense in which this approach doesn't want to come out squarely and say America is ill-founded and therefore the political economy with its three pillars is ill-founded within the American tradition. They want to say it's sort of. Not quite right. And there is a lot, shall we say, of the role of accident that takes place in this interpretation. So force is softened and accident occurs. Perhaps the one of the easiest examples to look at is Gordon Wood. To take a look at, well, how do you explain the American Revolution? Americans stumbled into it. If you take a look at David McCulloch, 1776, what is the American Revolution all about? Americans stumble into it. There are no ideas around. It's just accident that it all happened. And if you take a look at Beeman, the book that deals with the Constitutional Convention. He wants to say that it's not, Beard is wrong, it's not nastily founded, but there are elites, and they're the left out folks. And what is the debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists? Well, who are his Anti-Federalists? They're Smiley and other Western Pennsylvanians who are not exactly who I would choose to be the representative of the Anti-Federalist position, like Brutus or Federal Farmer. So there's a soft kind of class war that's going on in the Gordon Wood, but and there's a lot of accident that takes place. That it's so that force is softened, but there's no deliberation and choice, and that gets me to the last issue: force. The left. Accident, this soft stuff. Where does deliberation on choice or intent fit in? Is capitalism, broadly understood, intentional or accidental or forceful at the founding? And the seems to me the transitional figure here is our own Forrest MacDonald, who asked the very vital question in one of his last or his last public appearances, which was at Liberty Fund, supported conference in Indianapolis. And he asks, we all think that capitalism is the American way, and by that he means a defense of private property, and doesn't necessarily look at three pillars, but looks at this one pillar. And he says, yeah, but did the framers actually intend or contemplate this? And his answer is, no, it's an accident. But we got it anyway. So how did we get it? But why is it an accident? Because he says because America in 1787 was basically agrarian, parochial, backward-looking, small Montesquieu, and small republic in the Republican sense of Pocock and all the way back to the classics. They did not embrace the Enlightenment. They did not embrace the new model. And so they did not produce a document, the Constitution, which embodies what we might call the capitalist way. But we got it. How did we get it? By the accident of Hamilton and his forceful nature, by his understanding of the role of money and monetizing everything. Therefore, we, in effect, stumbled into capitalism, not because of the intent of the framers, but because of the statesmanship of Hamilton and his forceful nature. I think that is one of the best statements that we can deal with, and the way in which we can honor Forrest is to take him on. And in my remaining moments, I'm going to do that. And what I'm going to suggest is that the Constitution is intentionally capitalistic. And Forrest uses the private property notion very importantly, and therefore he looks to this obligation of contracts clause, which he says quite correctly that Rufus King introduced, but somehow it was overturned and got lost, only to reappear again. Well, it reappeared again in the Committee on Style, of which Rufus King was a member, along with Hamilton and Madison. And Gouverneur Morris, as well as Mr. Livingston from from Connecticut. And those people collected the deliberations which had taken place, and the contract clause becomes part of that. So it may have got lost and reappeared strangely, but it was part of a long conversation. If we were to also take a look at this Committee on Style, made up of these five people, not just Hamilton. By the way, Hamilton, according to MacDonald, came from the outside, therefore he had an outsider's view, he didn't have to be parochial. That is true. But Donald Trump, to the contrary notwithstanding, 20% of the framers were immigrants. We probably have to put a moat on the East Coast. And they were not exact. So Hamilton was not the only non-parochial. There were a whole bunch of them who were very interested in what I would call the Enlightenment project. It's not only the obligation of contract. There's a phrase in coming out of the Committee on Style which makes its way into the Constitution, which is not very much observed, which fits in wonderfully with what we just heard about Adam Smith. That is the concept of improvement. And how do you improve? Through the development of the sciences and the useful arts. And that is in Article 1, Section 8, an extremely important phrase for patents to be dispensed for limited time, not 100 years, perhaps for 20 years, which is a decade. And I think that phrase is important because it ties right in with Adam Smith's understanding of improvement. If you take a look at Article 1, Section 8, which is the result of deliberation and choice, there are 18 powers which are listed in Article 1, Section 8. The first 8 deal with commerce or political economy, taxation and interstate commerce and international commerce. And then let us not forget Madison's June 6th speech, in which he has this conversation with Sherman. Are people happier in large, extended commercial republics, Madison, or are they happier in small, in effect, agrarian communities, Sherman? And that becomes the issue. In a sense, we get a modified Madison version, but at the same time, Madison prevails. And if we want to see Smith, wealth of nations depends on the productivity of labor. Productivity of labor depends on the division of labor. Division of labor depends on the extent of the market. Madison, the well-being of a country depends on the control of faction. Control of faction depends on the division of interest. The division of interest depends on the extent of the orbit. There's Smith. In the sense, whether he absorbed it in that fashion or not, it seems to me there's the Enlightenment, there's Adam Smith, there's the, how do you get political liberty? A competition between religions. How do you get economic liberty? Competition between economic interests. How do you get political liberty? Competition between political interests. The key for the framers is anti-monopoly, competition. Let me end by suggesting that there is this free interconnection between political, economic, and a moral or religious, that the framers understood what they were doing. They did not stumble into things. They were not nasty. We do not need to apologize for them. We do not need to think that they are, that the founding is ill-founded or only incompletely founded. Some of the finest scholars, our friends, still are embarrassed by the founding. They wish that there was Sparta there. They wish that there was not so crass, perhaps commercial. But I am here to say that founders are not completers. Founders lay the foundations. And what did they lay? They laid the foundation for political, economic, and religious liberty, interconnected with each other, and in a non-embarrassing way, which we can embrace. Thank you.